Welcome to the Air Force Doctrine Podcast. My name is Keith Conway. On this episode, I sit down with Dr. Richard Muller, Professor of Military History at the U.S. Air Force School of Advanced Air and Space Studies, or SAS, at Maxwell Air Force Base, Alabama. Dr. Muller spent 14 years on the faculty at the U.S. Air Force Air Command and Staff College before joining the SAS faculty in 2005, and previously served as the SAS Dean of Academics. Today, we discuss General George Kinney, commander of Allied Air Forces in the Southwest Pacific area of World War II, and his unique approach to leadership and command and control of air power in his theater, and how it relates to modern air task force concepts. Please join us.
Of course, we're here today to talk about the Far East Air Forces, the Allied Air Forces in the Southwestern Pacific, and General Kinney. So let's start by talking about the man himself. Who was General George Kinney?
George Kinney has to be considered a plank owner in the United States Air Force. He basically grew up in the aviation age. As a young kid, he watched a flying display and decided he wanted to do that. He had a distinguished combat career in World War I, flying reconnaissance aircraft. And in World War I, he got a lot of ideas about air superiority and how important it was to operations. He also had a highly technical background. He spent some time at MIT, so he understood the engineering aspects of aviation. Probably had a broader education than many airmen of his age, and I think this helped him become a better joint air commander in the Southwest Pacific.
So he spent a lot of time at different, what we would consider PME schools in the interwar period between World War I and World War II. What kind of schools did he go to, and how did that shape his experience?
Yeah, you have to understand, during the interwar period, budgets were very tight and promotions were very slow, and retention was a big problem. So one of the ways all the services kept some of their best people was to send them to school, and they would have more school time and more school faculty time than might be normal today. So it was cheaper to send somebody to school, and it also gave them exposure to other branches and other services. So George Kinney spent a tour at the Air Corps Tactical School, or ACTS. By the time he was there, it was at Langley. It later moved to Maxwell, where it became very famous as the incubator of bombardment doctrine. But Kinney was the instructor in attack aviation. Remember, his background was in more tactical aviation in World War I, and he believed that air power had a role to play on the battlefield in support of land force scheme of maneuver. And he really championed that and pioneered a lot of ideas that he was later able to operationalize. Now, from Air Corps Tactical School, he was selected to go to the Army Command and General Staff College at Leavenworth, and then after that, Army War College. He had a lot of negative things to say about his experiences at both those schools. He said they were just too ground-focused, which I suppose was understandable since they were both Army schools, but he said they gave the air dimension very little coverage and short shrift. And he's in his memoirs, he's very uncomplimentary about his experience there. But the fact is, he met a lot of people who would later be instrumental in his campaign in the Southwest Pacific. People like General Eichelberger, people like General Sutherland, who was MacArthur's chief of staff. He had met these individuals in school, and when he then had to work with them in the Southwest Pacific, he kind of understood them. There was a basis for a relationship. So the personal connections that he made in PME, I think, were very important in his development.
Was it during this time that he was at school that the Field Manual 100-20, Command and Employment of Air Power, is that when that was developed?
No. Field Manual 100-20 came out of the early war experiences in both Europe and the Pacific. But that sort of put into Air Force doctrine, or Army Air Force's doctrine, by 1943. Basic principles that I think we would all recognize today, that air power and ground power are co-equal and independent, and interdependent, and that neither is an auxiliary of the other, to quote the manual. And that sort of culminated the thinking, which Kinney epitomized, that you don't have air power simply attached to ground power as an auxiliary, but as a fully independent force that is able to produce a decision in concert with the other branches of the military.
Right, and that's very much in line with what our doctrine says today.
Yes, if you're interested, this is available. You can pull it up on the internet on PDF, and you read it. It has a very modern feel to it. It's one of the really instrumental documents to understand the Air Force.
Let's transition to talking about General Kenney and his leadership of the Allied Air Forces in the Southwest Pacific area. Describe for us the tactical situation that Kenney was facing in the Southwest Pacific when he took command of 5th Air Force in 1942.
One thing to understand is that in the first months of the World War II in the Pacific, or what the Japanese call the Great East Asia War, the Japanese had basically run the table. Their run of conquests was every bit as impressive as the German Blitzkrieg in the West in 1940, and actually covered much more of the globe. They were in a position to threaten Australia. They had a foothold in New Guinea. They had conquered a defense perimeter, which was going to be very hard to assault because they were able to operate on interior lines. And they had secured access to the raw materials, the resources zone that they needed to sustain their war effort. So turning back the Japanese march of conquest and striking directly at the Japanese Empire was going to be a very difficult strategic, operational, and tactical problem. And there's quite a bit of debate about how to do that. The U.S. Navy wanted to engage the Japanese in a thrust across the Central Pacific in line with their pre-war War Plan Orange. And there were others that were advocating a multi-front assault, in this case through the Southwest Pacific. This is where General MacArthur comes in. MacArthur was in command in the Philippines. Franklin Roosevelt decided to pull him out, kind of as a symbol of American commitment to the area and national resistance. And MacArthur was an incredibly dominant personality, and it was essentially necessary to carve out a whole war theater in order to house his ambitions. There was also a strategic rationale for that. If you could augment the Central Pacific thrust with a drive through the Southwest Pacific leading to the Philippines, you would complicate Japanese defensive problems. And so there was both a personal and an operational strategic reason to create a separate war theater in the Southwest Pacific. George Kenney was assigned to be the airman, the JFAC, essentially, for MacArthur. He had to sort of clean up some wreckage from the first months of the war. MacArthur was not enamored of his airmen or the Air Force's performance during the early months of the war, and was quite disillusioned. And basically, it was up to Kenney to prove to MacArthur that the Air Force could deliver the goods. And as both Kenney's biographer, Thomas Griffith, and Kenney himself in his memoirs describes, his first hard job was the sales job he had to do for General MacArthur to convince him the Air Force could do the job and that he was the man to lead it.
So the gentleman who was in command of 5th Air Force and was working for MacArthur prior to General Kenney was General Brett.
That was George Brett, yes. He gets kind of a bad rap. He was dealt a very bad hand. I mean, none of the American military institutions were fully prepared for war in the Pacific. And he bore the brunt of MacArthur's ire for what happened during the early months. There's some evidence that things were starting to improve slowly, but MacArthur had run out of patience. Now, Brett did tell Kenney a number of things. He back-briefed him on what the challenges he would face. He said, you've got to deal with MacArthur's staff, particularly his chief of staff, General Sutherland. He viewed as an impediment. He said, this guy is writing op orders directly to my air units. He's bypassing me, and I just couldn't deal with that. And so Kenney knew he had to deal with this guy straight off. So there's a very dramatic episode described in Kenney's memoirs where he walks in, Sutherland tries to take charge, and Kenney pulls out a sheet of paper, draws a tiny dot in one corner, and says, this little dot represents what you know about air power. The rest of the sheet shows what I know about air power. Now let's go next door and we'll tell General MacArthur what's up and he'll decide who's going to run the air show. And as Kenney tells it, the chief of staff backed down immediately and said, oh, I'm sorry. I had to give orders to the Air Force because no one else was doing it. Of course, you're in charge. He did have problems with MacArthur's staff all through the war, but he had established himself as the authority on air matters. He also very carefully cultivated a relationship with MacArthur. He found out what time MacArthur would eat lunch, and he would make sure that he was always there. They had some sort of a personal exchange, you know, downtime, or they could just talk. And he said, the way I was going to win MacArthur's confidence was to deliver the goods. And so he realized that the Air Force had to win some big successes early in the Southwest Pacific in order to restore the confidence of MacArthur.
So General Kenney did a lot of relationship building between his time at his development schools in the interwar period and as he's taking command. to build and cultivate relationships with those individuals in his chain of command, both at the echelons above him and lateral to him as well. And that's in line with one of our mission command principles of building mutual trust. I thought that that was a very interesting thing to read about when I was researching this, is how he went about building those professional and personal relationships to cultivate that environment of trust, and getting MacArthur to understand how willing he was to take charge and take responsibility, but that he also needed a level of trust and flexibility if he was going to execute the job to the best of his ability.
He was very demanding. In fact, he wore out the patience of his boss, General Hap Arnold, in Washington, because he was always demanding more aircraft, more materiel, and more personnel. But he got some key personnel established in the theater, and from that, he began building these up-and-down relationships. As I said, he cultivated the relationship with MacArthur. He dealt with the staff, where he could deal directly with MacArthur on most important issues. And he also, he would put key people like Whitehead into important positions and then support them, but not micromanage them. He also had a very good touch with the enlisted personnel and people like the maintainers and all that. A Colonel Griffith's biography talks about some of these examples. The president of Bulova donated 100 Bulova watches to the 5th Air Force and suggested that they go to the pilots. And General Kenney said, you know what, I'm going to give these to the maintenance troops. They're the ones who keep the pilots in the air. They're the ones I want to have this recognition. So that was the kind of relationship building he did, both up and down the chain, and established himself as a demanding boss with high standards, but one who looked out for his people. He also got rid of a lot of the regs and a lot of the red tape that was impeding things like maintenance and supply. He took a look at the supply system and said, well, to use a modern term, this is whack. This is simply not going to work. And he streamlined things like the depots and how the supply system operated, and really put the command back on a paying basis. He was also incredibly generous with medals, to the point where there were complaints from other theaters that Southwest Pacific was showering decorations down on their people. And Kenney said, you know what? I saw in the First World War that these ribbons and medals can motivate people in difficult situations. We're in a backwater war theater. The climate is terrible. The disease rate is high. We need to somehow make our people feel respected. And if giving medals helps with that, I'm all for it. The decoration rate ran higher in 5th Air Force than in other commands, and he was fine with that.
Let's talk a little bit more about the geography of the Southwest Pacific Theater. So before we came over here, I just got on Google Maps and I used a little measuring tool just to see what the distances were involved in. General Kenney had his headquarters set up initially in Brisbane, Australia, mm-hmm. and then established an ADVON in Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea. Yes. That distance is about 1,300-ish miles. So that's roughly the distance from Tucson, Arizona to where we are here at Maxwell Air Force Base. And then the distance from there at Port Moresby to Rabaul, which was the primary Japanese base that they were trying to affect at that time, was another 500 miles, which is roughly the distance between here and Orlando, Florida. A lot of distances involved, a lot of water out there. Can you tell us a little bit more about the geography and the climatology of what's going on in the South Pacific and Papua New Guinea and that New Britain area?
Yeah, it's really one of the most inhospitable places in the world to fight a war. I think maybe the Aleutian Islands are more difficult for different reasons, but virtually every memoir that you read about the war, the jungle war in the Southwest Pacific, the New Guinea campaign, talks about the impassable terrain, the amount of dangerous insects and diseases. In fact, one of my professors once commented that in New Guinea, athlete's foot swiftly became athlete's head. These fungi would infect you and your health would be ruined after a six-month stint in the theater. The climate was terrible. Rainstorms would come up unexpectedly. The Owen Stanley Mountains were often shrouded in clouds, and it was just a very difficult place to fight. Getting stuff in to the theater was difficult, and then distributing it within the theater was extremely problematic as well. So those all had to be overcome. And Kenney made it clear to his bosses that the bad hand he'd been dealt, and then expected some support and expected some supply. He didn't always get what he wanted. One of Arnold's staff officers, who I wrote about once, General Whalen, said, you know, it seemed to me that George Kenney was living beyond his means. But the fact is, he was always going to bat for his troops and always demanding more stuff to let them fight in the area. And that's one thing that hasn't changed. It is still very difficult to get across this part of the world with any kind of military force quickly. It's possible to get there quickly, and it's possible to get there powerfully, but it's very difficult to do both. And that has not changed in the 80 years that have passed since George Kenney was doing his thing.
And given these challenges, it's the tyranny of distance that we talk about with our current Pacific theater, the weather, the lack of actual terra firma to put an airfield on, how did he choose to provide command control to his forces in the Southwest Pacific Theater during his tenure as command?
It was very clear that MacArthur was the theater commander, MacArthur was the joint force commander, and Kenney bought into the idea that he worked for MacArthur. Now, this caused him great trouble, particularly later in the war, with his, you might say, real boss, General Hap Arnold in Washington, who would have to remind George Kenney that he was still in the Army Air Forces and that he worked for Arnold. But Kenney said, no, this is a theater operation, a theater campaign. I actually need to carry MacArthur's water. I think Arnold almost fired him, and his biographer, Tom Griffith, agrees with that. Kenney was just successful enough and just far away enough that Arnold basically let him get away with it. He fired a lot of people for a lot less than that. But so that was established that Kenney was going to be MacArthur's joint airman. And so below Kenney, particularly when Kenney took over Far East Air Forces, he has two numbered air forces working for him, the 5th Air Force, by then under the command of General Whitehead. Kenney established the commander's intent, but he empowered his numbered Air Force commanders, and even down to his group commanders, the actual planning and execution of the operations. He would issue very concise, usually one-page directives about what the operation was supposed to accomplish, and then he would trust his staffs and his commanders to implement this guidance. And so you had an individual who had a vision for how the theater air campaign was going to function, but he vested a lot of authority in these subordinate elements who would then actually fight the air war,
right?
Essentially.
It seemed like he did a very good job of giving his intent and his guidance, and then he was also very willing to delegate as much of the planning and execution authority that he could down to the subordinate levels.
Yes.
So initially, when General Kenney takes over his first command in the Southwest Pacific Theater, he's the commander of 5th Air Force.
Yes.
And General Whitehead is his deputy. And again, like we mentioned, he sends General Whitehead forward to Port Moresby as an ADVON team. And he delegates a lot of this authority to execute to General Whitehead.
That's correct.
And then General Whitehead, as he has his forces and they begin to spread out on the island of Papua New Guinea, the Japanese forces are on the north coast. They're on the south coast, separated by the Owen Stanley Mountains in the middle. As he begins to gain air superiority and move forces forward and begin to push forces off of the north coast of Papua New Guinea, how does the command and control structure change?
Well, partly because the theater of operations is huge, as you stressed. If you lay a map of New Guinea to scale on top of Western Europe, you'll find it covers most of Western and Central Europe. I mean, we're talking about very, very long distances. And when you look at the German Blitzkrieg in 1940 or Patton's dash across France, you think, wow, that's really incredible. There are no less incredible feats being carried out in the Southwest Pacific. And you've also got a lot of water to deal with. So it's incredibly difficult. And one way to deal with it is to create these what were called air task forces, which Kenney essentially pioneered in the theater. And they were tailored for operations in the theater. They did not exist in Army Air Forces organization at the time. They weren't really part of the table of organizations and equipment. You had squadrons, groups, wings, and whatnot. That wouldn't have worked as well in the theater like this. So he creates these ad hoc task forces. It gives command of those task forces to officers who had demonstrated the ability to use their initiative and to seize the opportunities. And these task forces then will carry out these individual operations that make up the Southwest Pacific campaign. WEWAC, BUNA, places like that are supported by Kenney's air task forces. And he had a formula that he developed, which everyone understood. The chain of events was essentially gain air superiority first and foremost. I mean, he learned that the hard way in the First World War, flying reconnaissance missions against, you know, very aggressive German pursuit planes, then put up an air blockade to prevent the Japanese from reinforcing. You would then hammer the enemy's positions and destroy their frontline defenses. You would then assist the friendly troops with close air support and battlefield air interdiction, as it used to be called. And then finally, you would seize the territory, build more air bases, and using the range of your medium bombers, push what he called the bomber line forward and advance the scheme. This was also tied into MacArthur's island hopping campaign. Really strong points of Japanese resistance, like Rabaul, you would think, okay, you need to attack them at their main center of gravity. MacArthur's idea was, no, places like Rabaul, you just isolate them. You let them wither on the vine, and you seize bases around them and just let the war pass them by. And essentially, the Southwest Pacific campaign employs what Basil Liddell-Hart called the indirect approach. You don't hit where the enemy is strongest. You hit where they're weakest and simply bypass and isolate the strong points.
Let's talk a little bit about how the air task forces were structured. Can you speak a little bit to how he developed them and what an air task force usually consisted of and how he equipped them for success?
Yeah, as I said, it's an ad hoc organization. The basic building block would normally be a bomber group, normally a medium bomber group, say 48 aircraft, if at full strength, which they rarely were. And then you would augment that force with enough pursuit planes to escort it. You would bring in Marine aviation units from the theater, which could also be folded in. And as I said, they'd be under the command of a talented officer who had shown the ability to handle combat forces without a lot of guidance from above. One of the Air Task Force commanders was General Earl Barnes, who was the first post-war commandant of Air Command and Staff College. You may be familiar with Barnes Auditorium, but he was the type of officer who kind of made his bones flying operations in the Southwest Pacific, who was given larger and larger responsibilities, in this case, command of the 13th Air Task Force.
All right, so according to Air Force Doctrine Publication 1-1, our Mission Command publication, distributed control enables commanders to delegate authorities for planning, coordination, execution, and assessment activities to disperse locations to achieve an effective span of control and maintain the initiative, particularly in contested environments. Distributed control is a mechanism that a commander uses to delegate authority to a lower level and empower those echelons to still be able to execute without all of the decisions and planning having to be made at a centralized location. How does General Kenney set his air task forces up to execute distributed control in his theater?
Okay, it actually, as we were talking about this, it actually just occurred to me, it's kind of like thinking of it as a fractal approach. The ATF is, in essence, a miniature numbered air force in the Southwest Pacific. It had most of the combat types. It had organic, built around a bombardment group. It had pursuit planes for escort and ground support. It had reconnaissance assets. It could also pull assets from Marine units that were in theater, but it sort of replicated on a smaller scale the larger organization from which it sprung. As I said, they were under the command of innovative officers who did not need a lot of guidance. Remember, Kenney's memos were usually about a page long explaining what the intent was. And they would go out, they would operate in a certain geographic area. They could support others when needed. They could pull resources from other areas. Also, Kenney made sure that these ATFs got the same level of intel support, the same level of engineering support. Things like building and maintaining runways was a huge problem in the Southwest Pacific, and also the supply problem, which was potent. And he did rely on the Navy to supply a lot of the material for that. That idea that you could let go and allow the miniaturized commands to operate independently or quasi-independently was a step ahead. You really don't see that in Europe. You have very innovative organizations like 9th and 19th Tactical Air Commands. They're more centralized. You don't see this kind of fragmentation of the units, which is usually considered a bad thing. But in the Southwest Pacific, it was necessary to do it this way. It was really the right solution for the theater.
So what were some of General Kenney's major successes, and what were some of the major challenges that he also faced in the theater?
Well, probably the major success that he's most familiar with was in March of 43, the Battle of the Bismarck Sea. The Japanese were desperate to tip the balance on New Guinea, and they were bringing in a large supply convoy of troops to reinforce the island. This was partly in response to one of Kenny's aerial insertions of ground troops, which the Japanese were determined to checkmate. And in this case, this is used as an example in Air Force doctrine for at least the last 20 years. I've seen it used frequently. It's a case where air independently thwarted a surface operation. In this case, a convoy of merchant ships, supply ships, and escorting destroyers was almost completely destroyed by Kenny's air power. This was his B-25s. This was Australian bow fighters. It was a combined operation. It was pretty gruesome. It was a bloodbath. The Japanese troops in the water were often strafed. The Pacific War was incredibly brutal. There was a lot of racism on both sides. And Kenny's, actually, his memoir is filled with racist comments about the Japanese, when it's definitely a period piece in that regard. But this was a case where air power really did decide the outcome of a substantial operation. That's probably his most famous victory, but there were many other campaigns and operations to which his air units contributed. By the time the war moved to the Philippines, it was almost like the war had gotten too big for one man to handle. He's probably not as successful in the large-scale combat operations in the Philippines. There's a lot of logistical problems that have to be overcome. But by and large, this formula, this air task force formula, is very workable for much of the South Pacific AOR. And you mentioned perhaps some weaknesses. Like all great commanders, he had his blind spots and he had shortcomings. He was a brilliant theater air commander. I think no one can take that away from him. But he had a tendency towards tunnel vision. He assumed his theater was the most important. He assumed that his theater was entitled to get the B-29 bomber, the brand new long-range bomber, that his theater would get it. Arnold was never going to do that. The B-29 had a strategic mission upon which the independence of the Air Force post-war depended. Kenny was never going to get the bomber. He not only insisted that he get it, he actually started building airfields to accommodate the new bomber, even though there was no chance in a million that he was going to get one. For you mobility folks out there, one area the pre-war Army Air Force's planning got wrong was they underestimated the sheer number of transport planes that were going to be necessary to wage this global war. Kenny never had enough transport planes as he thought he needed in the Southwest Pacific, but he did miracles with what he had. You'll see airdrops, you'll see air landing, and you'll see supply runs. He basically converted airliners to supply the troops and to bring supplies forward into this inhospitable environment. So our mobility does catch up. By the end of World War II, the greatest airline in the world is the United States Army Air Forces. But going into the war, that was a shortcoming which Kenny struggled to overcome.
Now, fast forward to 2024. This past fall, the Secretary of the Air Force and his office released a white paper on modern U.S. Air Force air task forces. So the U.S. Air Force is now looking to transition itself into an air task force type structure. What do you think are some of the similarities and differences between the new air task force concept and General Kenny's air task forces in the South Pacific in World War II?
Well, the biggest difference is Kenny's air task forces did not exist in Army Air Force's doctrine or table of organization and equipment. It was an ad hoc creation tailored to the theater that Kenny did out of hide. If you will, there was no budget line item to organize, train, and equip air task forces. He did it using the resources and tools he had, assembling things in new ways. It was a theater-specific response to a problem. Now, the thinking today is we may well be operating roughly the similar AOR, and we may need something like this. I think the major effort underway today, having reviewed the latest writings on this, is to formalize but not over-formalize the concept and give it a place in Air Force doctrine and thinking so that it's part of our lineup, essentially. So this isn't something that you have to depend on a theater air commander to come up with in response to a demand in theater, that you have this already inculcated, already being institutionalized and socialized with the force. And a lot of these new publications stress the new ways of thinking that are going to be required in order to make this successful.
Modern air task forces, or that we're looking at now is still a concept as of right now. So whether or not we're going to achieve the same level of distributed control that Kenny had with his air task force in the South Pacific is still to be seen. Currently, we're trying to develop air task forces with the first one being employed here in a couple of years. And those first few are going to be experimental in nature. So I think there's still a lot to be seen, but a lot of salient lessons learned from General Kenny and his experiences in the Pacific on how to use mission command, how to foster mission command culture within an organization to enable air task forces to be successful. As we look at our modern mission command document, General Kenny does a lot of the things that we've discussed. He creates shared understanding by sharing his intent and by sharing his intelligence. He fosters innovation through exercising discipline initiative, and he accepts prudent risk when it's necessary to get the job done within his theaters. He builds trust and builds relationships, and he uses mission type orders and provides clear commander's intent. All of these are the principles of mission command that we have now in our modern doctrine. Well, Dr. Mueller, this has been a fantastic conversation. Where can we go to learn more about General Kenny and his command and control and leadership in World War II?
All right. There are two books that I would definitely recommend if you want to get a more robust understanding of what we've been talking about. Very few American airmen bothered to write memoirs after World War II, which is really a shame because there are a lot of stories that went untold. But General Kenny did write a memoir, General Kenny Reports. It has tremendous strengths, but it also has some weaknesses. But that is a firsthand account of a JFAC learning and practicing his craft, and I highly recommend that. Now, the best overall treatment of Kenny's work is the book that we have used many years at SAS, Thomas E. Griffith, Jr., MacArthur's Airman, General George C. Kenny and the War in the Southwest Pacific. I had just a little anecdote about this book. I've had a lot of very fine students, but one of them, she actually did not get the assignment that she had hoped for, but she was determined to make the best of it. And I was talking to her during her comprehensive exam, and my last question was something like, okay, when you're in command of your next unit, are there any books from SAS that you would recommend that your people read? And she said, actually, there is one, and it's the Kenny book. I think they should read that. And I said, you know, why? Thinking, well, innovation. Or she said, the message of that book to me is bloom where you're planted. George Kenny didn't want to go to the Southwest Pacific. He probably wanted to go to Europe, but he got to the Southwest Pacific and said, this is where I'm going to, you know, do my thing and where I'm going to make my mark. And that was her approach to her next job. And she did extraordinarily well with that. And I thought that was a great answer to that question.
Absolutely. It's fantastic. Well, Dr. Mueller, this has been a great conversation. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks very much.
That's going to do it for this week's podcast. This show is recorded, edited, and produced by the LeMay Center's Doctrine Outreach Section. Special thanks to Dr. Mueller, the School for Advanced Air and Space Studies, and Air University. As always, the views expressed by our panel members are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Air University, the Air Force, or any government agency. I'm Keith Conway, and we will see you next time.